it's my understanding, based on the way the material shifts, that verses 1 through 10 were a paragraph that had to do primarily with the question that was raised in verse 1. I say then, or am I saying, that God has rejected his people? And the answer is no, absolutely not. And that comes on the heel of chapter 10, verse 12. He said in verse 21, chapter 10, that God had been holding his stretched out hands out all day long to unpersuaded and argumentative people. And so the obvious implication is that because Israel's being so resistant, that God would turn away from them. And that was rooted in the fact that there was a historical turning away, because that was the whole issue of the New Testament, with Paul's apostleship to the Gentiles, with the descent of the Spirit on the day of Pentecost, and all these 16 different languages are being heard by the Jews that have come to Jerusalem from all these different places that they've been dispersed, and the statements made by the apostles that God was extending the gospel to the Gentiles in a way that he'd never done before. And so the implication was that God was fed up with those people that crucified his son, wasn't going to have anything else to do with them. And that's the question that Paul asked. Is that the right conclusion to draw? And the answer was no. So this first 10 verses is a reaction or a restatement of that particular thesis, that God has a legitimate right to reject these willfully disbelieving and argumentative people that he's been holding his hands out to all day long. And prior to that, he'd actually said that Israel didn't get what it wanted, and the Gentiles didn't even know what they wanted, and they got it. So there's this explanation in this whole section on God's greater plan. So in the 10 verses, he's dealing with that, and he's dealing with Elijah, and Elijah as a prophet in the northern kingdom was basically alone, and he felt his aloneness, and he even complained to God that he was the only one left. And God said, no, I have 7,000 men that I have kept for myself. And Paul argues from there that that means that there is a remnant according to grace. And if it's by grace, it's not by law. If it's by grace, it's going to be accomplished on the basis of God's initiative and his deliberate refusal to consider what they deserve. So they have been disobedient and willfully resistant and argumentative. And Paul wrote all that stuff because he'd been that way. So he's arguing, in effect, that God's greater plan includes bringing the Gentiles in, but it does not include a rejection of all the promises that he made about Israel to the fathers. He's going to keep those promises, but there is an interim in there. So when we get to verses 11 and 12, which I think are the next, it's a very brief paragraph, but I think it's the next paragraph in the book, he says this: am I saying then that they stumbled so as to fall? No. And that's almost exactly the same thought as verse 1. The issue is God going to respond to these people in such a way that they have no future with him? And so that's where we're going to go this evening. In other words, he's basically repeating his thesis or his question from verse 1. So this is a restatement of it. So what we've basically been seeing is that Paul's major concern for his readers is that they are liable to draw the wrong conclusion that is stated in the statement, God has rejected Israel for their willfulness and their rebelliousness. And he says that's not the right conclusion to draw. The problem that sticks out in this is that he talks about it in terms of his people, Israel, because he talks about the fact that he's an Israelite and he's one of these people that is involved in this whole issue of whether God has rejected his people whom he foreknew. And they all end up being this question of Israel. And that's basically what he's dealing with in verses 11 and 12, whether God's plan included a shift in focus of message and a focus of audience, but without the conclusion that he has basically forsaken all his commitments to Israel because they've become so degenerate that they murdered his son when he sent him among them. Paul doesn't want the people to draw that false conclusion. He wants Israel to be properly understood. And there's no question at all that Israel deserves to be rejected. They have been persistent in their willfulness. They have been, the gravity of their sin was over the top. Because there is nothing worse than for a creature to rebel against a creator and then murder him if you can. And of course, Jesus addressed that issue of if you can by just point blank for saying, nobody takes my life from me. I lay it down myself and I have power to take it again. I got this from my Father and there's not a single solitary thing you can do about it. He didn't say all that. But the point is, God allowed his son to be crucified by God's people, Israel. And that was the worst, the most grievous sin that could be possibly committed. There is no greater sin. And you can argue that from the fact that death being permitted to intrude into the nature of the living God by the Son and the Father having to be separated because the Son has become sin. You can argue it on that basis that this is an impossible thing to grasp. Human beings cannot understand how God could allow death to be a part of his nature as the living God for the sake of sinners. And you can argue it on the other side. What's the greatest commandment? Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So what's the worst sin you can commit? Not to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So what does murdering God mean? Well, that you don't love him. So in any case, there's no doubt that Paul understands that his audience might jump to the conclusion that God's finally going to get fed up here, that even the long-suffering of God has an end to it. But he doesn't want them to go to that. So to understand Paul, I think that there's a major concept regarding Israel that needs to be in place in our thinking. There's an analogy that is given to us in Matthew 3:12. And again, same analogy, same speaker, same setting, but it's recorded in Luke 3. Matthew 3:12 and Luke 3:17, and the speaker is John the Baptizer, and he's introducing Jesus. And he says in these two texts that the Christ that he's introducing has the winnowing fan in his hand, and he is going to blow the chaff away from the seed, and he's going to gather the seed into his barn, and he's going to burn the chaff with fire. He's introducing Jesus as the one who is going to baptize with his spirit and with fire. And the spirit part is his provision of the spirit to those who trust him, and the fire part is the warning of what happens if you don't trust him. You become part of the fuel for the flame. But in that statement, there is this imagery of a threshing floor that a great big pile of grain has been put at least nearby, or if not on the edge of. And the harvester, the one that owns the grain, is waving his purging fan over the threshing floor so that his helpers are throwing the grain on there, and I don't know how exactly they treaded it out. I don't know if this is one of those things where the oxen are moving around or not, because the same word is not used. The oxen tread out the corn, but this is wheat. But in any case, you have to have some kind of a disturbing thing going on that will cause the chaff to break away from the seed. And then you have the winnowing fan that's blowing, and as he waves it back and forth and the chaff is broken loose from the seed, the chaff blows over into the side wherever the wind blows it, and the seed is still lying there. And so they sweep it up and gather it into the barn. And this is a picture that John used to present the big picture of Jesus' activities as the Lord's Christ. And the thing that's important for us to recognize is that the entire pile is considered grain, even though the grain is covered with chaff. So that the grain with the chaff is considered to be the seed. So it's sifted so that you can separate the real seed, the essence of seed, from the chaff that's just an attachment around it. It serves its purpose early on to protect the seed and enable it to develop properly. But nonetheless, at the harvest, there is no use for this chaff, so they need to separate it out. I think that Paul in Romans, and particularly in chapter 11, is using that same kind of idea for Israel, because Israel is like the pile of grain on the threshing floor, and his argument has already been in Romans that there is an Israel within Israel, that there is this elect remnant, and the 7,000 that haven't bowed the knee to Baal in the northern kingdom are a part of this remnant of grace. These are the true Israelites, and all of these others that are calling themselves the sons of Jacob, Israel, are Israelites, but they're chaff, because they don't ever come into the characteristic of the seed, which is believing in Jesus of Nazareth as the Christ. So there's, in a sense, an elect seed. Then there is a hardened chaff, and that's what he's talking about in verse 7 when he says, what Israel is seeking for, it hasn't obtained, but those who were chosen obtained it. In other words, the elect remnant get it, and the rest are hardened. That doesn't mean they are hardened by God at that point. It just means they are a hardened entity. And because of their hardness, they have not believed, and they get blown away. In Romans 9, if you remember back in Romans 9, verses 6 and following, Paul already made this point of there being an Israel within Israel. And there is the hardened seed of Israel, who are identified as the sons of Israel, but they're children of his flesh. And then there is the elect seed, which is the sons of Israel, who are identified as the children of promise. And the difference between them is both of them came through the physical lineage of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's where you get to Israel, because Jacob's name is Israel. But it's not the seed that comes as a natural production of having children and having offspring, because those are the children of the flesh. It's the children of promise that are the remnant element. And in the text, the first child of promise was Isaac. And he was proven to be a child of promise by God's deliberate refusal to allow Abraham and Sarah to produce him until it was impossible for them to produce him. And then God produced him through their physical flesh and all of that. But nonetheless, he was not a son of the flesh in the sense that their flesh had no capacity to produce him. He was produced by God because God had made a promise that he was going to keep. And he's called the child of promise. Well, in the same way, Isaac marries a woman who has trouble conceiving, and she's barren for a long time, and she gets on her husband about him not giving her children, and he said, hey, my fault, and on it goes. But then she conceives two at the same time, Jacob and Esau. Well, in that situation, she is told before the boys are ever born, before they've ever done anything, and that whole thing of done anything means we're not dealing with performance issues, legal things. God says the elder will serve the younger. So the outcome of it is that Esau is rejected by God as the heir of the issue of promise, and Jacob is given the position of the heir of the promise. And then he has two wives and two concubines, and he has 12 sons. And for the most part, they're pretty reprobate in their behavior up until they're confronted by their brother in Egypt, whom they had sold into slavery, and their terror of his vengeance drove them to a kind of what Paul would call in 2 Corinthians godly sorrow that brings about repentance. So Jacob's sons, the initial sons, came apparently to some kind of legitimate repentance with Joseph's influence over them. But the nation that developed from there produced an enormous number of children of flesh, natural progeny coming from marriages and stuff that for the whole nation. But within that group, God had made an election of grace, a remnant. And those were the children that were going to be the ones that fulfilled the promises that God made to Abraham about the nation. So you have to keep this in mind, that Israel is a mixed multitude at this point. It's part chaff and part seed, if we can use the Matthew 3 and Luke 3 imagery. At the end of chapter 10 of Romans, where he says, "But as for Israel, all day long I've stretched out my hands to a..." The word's translated disobedient, but it means unpersuaded, and the word translated opposite means they're argumentative. They're unpersuaded and argumentative. Every time you say anything, they're going to argue with you because they're not going to agree with you no matter what. Well, that kind of Israel in verse 21 had also within it certain people like Saul of Tarsus, who became the Apostle Paul, who was an Israelite. But he became a member of the group known as the elect because he was brought to faith by Jesus on the road to Damascus. And there were thousands of Jews in the first century under the preaching of Peter and the church in Jerusalem that proved themselves to be this remnant of grace that Israel contained. But the Israel that is identified in verse 21 is all obstinate and disobedient or unbelieving and argumentative. And yet he calls them Israel. Well, that's the name or the title of the people. That's the question is, well, does that mean that God is not going to have anything more to do with these people? He's given them 1,500 years and they have never gotten it. They don't want to get it. It doesn't matter what you say to them. They're going to argue with you about it. It's kind of like, you remember the story of Paul going up on, going into Jerusalem, and they start trying to beat him to death. And so the Romans come down and deliver him from the mob and take him out of there. And he says, "Well, can I talk to these people?" And the guy says, "Yeah, you can talk to them." So he stands up and he raises his hand and he starts talking to them in Hebrew. And though they wanted to kill him before that, as soon as they heard he was speaking in Hebrew, they got really, really quiet, so they could hear everything he had to say. And he gave them this testimony about how God had persuaded him that Jesus of Nazareth was the Christ. And he got all the way down to the point where he said that God told me that he was going to send me to the nations, to the Gentiles, with this message. And they erupted. And they wanted to kill him again. In fact, 40 of them bound themselves with an oath that they wouldn't eat or drink until Paul was dead. And I've always wondered what happened to those guys. But the point I'm trying to make is, when you are operating on that kind of level of antagonism, so that you're enraged by something that somebody says that God told him to do, you're just being obstinate and unbelieving. That's the issue. And the question is, well, just how long-suffering is God's long-suffering? When will it come to an end, and when is he going to be done with these people? And that's what Paul's dealing with throughout this whole section. So the question is, did they stumble? Did Israel stumble so as to fall? And is that what I'm trying to say? That's verse 11, the opening part. The grammar and language is just like verse 1. What am I saying here? Am I saying that God has rejected his people? That's verse 1. Or they stumbled so as to fall. Is that what I'm saying? And the answer is no! Absolutely not. Now, that's not the thing I want you to take home with you, that God is fed up with them. And the reason is because in the promise of God concerning Israel, you have initially a mixed multitude. And then you have within that group some who believe God. They're all called Israel, but Paul says there is a true Israel within Israel. The true Israel are the ones who actually are people who believe God's promises. And when you believe his promises, you put him on the hook to perform them. As soon as Abraham believed the promise of the land, seed, and the great name, God was on the hook for performing his promise. He could not do it and still be a God of integrity. So this statement, has God rejected his people? Did they stumble so as to fall? The answer has to be, it can't work that way, because God then turns into some kind of a deceiving liar. And I don't understand why people can't see that. But there's a huge group of Christendom today that say Israel has no future with God. He's done with them, in spite of the fact that they have been reestablished in the land, and in spite of a lot of other stuff. The fact is, they just don't believe that Israel has a place. And the reason they say that is because they say, well, you have to understand what God's intention was when he said what he said. His intention was that he was going to produce a group of Gentiles, make up the church, and then he was going to transfer all those promises he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob over to this group called the church. And that just won't fly. The only way you can be an Israelite, true or otherwise, is you have to be genetically connected to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. If you're not genealogically descended from Jacob, you're not an Israelite. I don't care who tells you otherwise. You're not a spiritual Israelite. You're not an Israelite at all. But that doesn't mean you're not a part of that elect remnant or that seed that's chosen by the purpose of grace, because he has a bigger purpose. And that's what chapters 9, 10, 11 about. Paul is explaining God's change of message and audience to a generation that had constantly been told the message is law and the audience is Israel. And that's all God's interested in. And he doesn't care about all those other nations. And then along comes Jesus and the apostles, and they say, no, the message is grace and the audience is everybody. So that's the reason for this change. So I think that one of the things that will help us to understand all of this is that even in the prophecies concerning Israel, if you look at chapter 11, verse 26, which is just a few verses from where we are, it says, and thus all Israel will be saved. He says, I don't want you to be uninformed of this mystery, lest you be wise in your own estimation, that a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles come in, and thus, after that happens, all Israel will be saved. Well, that means that there's going to come a time when everybody who's an Israelite is saved. Well, how is that going to work? Well, we're told in the prophecies of Daniel, in the prophecies of the book of the Revelation, in the instruction of the New Testament, the mixture that is called Israel, that has the chaff and the seed mix, is going to be winnowed by this great time of tribulation that Michael's going to create when he stands up in Daniel 12:1. And there's going to be this time of tribulation such as has never been before in the history of the whole of humanity. And it's going to be so bad that it's going to eliminate enormous numbers of people. 3/4, I believe, of the population of the world will be destroyed in that last period of great tribulation. And a whole bunch of those that are destroyed are people who are genealogically descended from Jacob or Israel, but they're not, many of them are not believers. And those who are believers are martyred, and they're pictured in the book of Revelation as those that are under the altar who've been put to death for their testimony concerning Jesus. And of course, there's a bunch of Gentiles that are martyred too. But my point is, when the time of the Gentiles is fulfilled, the only people who are going to be left that are true Israelites, that is, descendants of Israel, will also be believing. And that's when all Israel will be saved. Because this deliverer is going to come from Zion. He's going to remove ungodliness from Jacob. And this is my covenant with them when I take their sins away. That's what verse 26 and 27 of this chapter says. So basically, we have a big picture presented to us about how it is wrong to conclude that they stumbled so as to fall. He says they stumbled, but it wasn't in what he calls a fall. And what does that mean? Well, let's talk about this in terms of the translation in verse 11. It says they did not stumble so as to fall. And in our English translations, we have this statement over in chapter 9, verse 32 about Israel not arriving at the law of righteousness, though diligently pursuing it. And the question is why, in verse 32 of chapter 9, it says, because they didn't pursue it by faith. They pursued it as by works. And it says they stumbled over the stumbling stone. And the stumbling stone, of course, is Jesus. I lay in Zion a stone of stumbling, a rock of offense, and he who believes in him will not be disappointed. That's what chapter 9, verse 33 says. The fact that they translate that stumbling block and that they stumble over the stumbling stone, and then the translators use the word stumble here in verse 11, they're not the same word. And they don't mean the same. And it's puzzling to us because we're English readers and we just read it. And so we think, well, yeah, chapter 9 said they were going to stumble. And it's here it says they stumbled, but they didn't actually fall. And we'll talk about what that means in just a minute. But we need to understand this word stumble, because in chapter 9, there's a concept of somebody tripping over a rock that's in the way. That's the stumbling stone, and they trip over it. And basically, what they're tripping over is a metaphor. If you were doing it physically, it would be you're walking in a path, somebody put a rock in your path, and you were occupied some other way, and you didn't see it, and so when you got to it, you stumbled over it. That's the imagery in chapter 9. The word that's translated stumble here is a translation of a term that's only used four times in the New Testament altogether, and two of them are in James 2:10 and James 3:2. The third one is here, and then there's one in 1 Peter or 2 Peter, I don't remember which one, but it says, if you do these things, you will never stumble. The point is that in James 2:10 and 3:2, it's very clear what the word stumble means there, because James says, we all stumble in many ways. What's he mean by that? He said he means we all sin in various and sundry ways. So the point there is that James is talking about stumbling by not doing something that you're commanded to do, or by doing something that you were prohibited from doing. That's called stumbling. It's not stumbling over a doctrinal reality like Jesus being the cornerstone. That's a stumbling of misunderstanding and lack of appreciation for who Jesus is. This kind of stumbling that's referred to here is the kind that's described in terms in chapter 10, verse 21. Being deliberately disbelieving and argumentative about everything. Those are the two characteristics of this kind of stumbling. Well, what he's really talking about is just being willfully sinful. Doing things you know you're not supposed to do, and not doing things you know you're supposed to do. And he says, in effect, did they grievously commit these sins of commission and omission to the point that they have now fallen? And that brings us to the question of what does it mean by fall? Well, the issue of falling in this immediate context is to come under the severe condemnation of God. Verse 22 says, behold the kindness and severity of God. To those who fell, severity. But to you, God's kindness. So the elect remnant get to benefit from the kindness of God, and the hardened Israelites who are argumentative and all that, they suffer the severity of God. And in the severity thesis, it's the condemnation that the law brings. So basically what we're dealing here still is this question in the minds of Paul's readers in Rome as to how am I supposed to view God? If I view God as predominantly just, then I'm going to view him as somebody who can get his belly full of willful disobedience to the point where he will say, okay, I'm done with you. And I'm going to bring you up at the great white throne judgment, and I'm going to force you to kneel, and I'm going to expose all your wickedness, and then I'm going to throw you in the lake of fire. That's the future for those who are of that stripe. And that's what he means. Did they stumble so that they might fall? Basically, what he's saying is, did Israel's offense in crucifying their Christ, was that so grievous that God has decided that he's going to have absolutely nothing more to do with Israel? And remember, Israel's a mixed bag here. So if God is done with Israel, that means he's done with the chaff and the seed. And the answer is, that can't be. Meganoita, no! That is not the conclusion to draw. Well, okay, Paul, what are we supposed to, what kind of conclusion are we supposed to draw? Verse 11 said, we're supposed to draw this conclusion. By their transgression, and this is a modified and a added to form of the word to stumble. It means to transgress. It means to deliberately step over a boundary that you're aware of. Their transgression has produced a reaction in God where he has opened the door of salvation to the Gentiles. In other words, God's reaction to Israel's rebelliousness is to push them aside temporarily and allow his reaction to their willfulness to motivate him to open the door to the Gentiles so they can be saved. And this is huge in light of the whole context of the first century, because the Jews couldn't stand the idea of Gentiles being brought up to their level of status in the eyes of God and men. They couldn't stand that thought. They called the Gentiles dogs, and they were, you know, they couldn't stand the notion that God would actually either demote them down to the level of the Gentiles or bring the Gentiles up to their level. Remember what Jesus told the lady at the well in Samaria? She was saying, well, you know, our fathers taught us that we were supposed to worship on this mountain, and you Jews say, and you know what Jesus said? He said, salvation's of the Jews. Like it or lump it. In other words, you're going to have to correct your attitude about what God has revealed to the Jews in relation to salvation. And if you knew who I was, you'd do that. And even the Syrophoenician woman brings her daughter, demon-possessed, and says, Jesus, would you cast this demon out of my daughter? No, I ain't going to give the bread of the children to the dogs. Well, the dogs get to lick up the crumbs under the table. And Jesus said, okay, I'll cast that demon out of your daughter. The point being, salvation is of the Jews. And Paul even said in this book, the gospel is to go to the Jews first and also to the Gentiles. But this whole thing is, Paul is arguing, look, you got to get rid of this legal way of thinking. When you read that these people are so grievously wicked, if you are thinking legally, you're thinking, okay, God's going to apply the law to them and destroy them. And you need to recognize that there may be a God of grace behind that picture who is actually using their hardness and their turning away from him. Remember what Paul said at the end of the book of Acts to the Jews? He said, since you consider yourselves unworthy of salvation, we're going to go to the Gentiles. So they're the ones, if anybody has turned away from anybody, it's the Jews that turned away from God, not God from the Jews. And the point being that what happened was fantastic. The Gentiles got to become full-blown heirs of the salvation that God had originally promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in Israel. And his next statement, which we're not going to get into this evening, but his next statement is now, look, if their transgression meant riches for the world, what do you suppose will happen when their promises are all fulfilled? I mean, if this huge good of salvation being given to them was caused by Israel's transgression, what do you suppose it'll mean for the Gentiles, for the Jews to actually be brought into the fulfillment of all these promises? We'll get into that next week, Lord willing. But the point I want to make to this is this. You have to understand that when Paul says, has God rejected his people and did they stumble so that they should fall? They're obviously thinking in terms of legal mindset. In other words, their God's a judge. And the whole New Testament is geared to try to shift that mindset from God is a God who's a judge to God is a God of grace. That's Paul's whole... Paul knows that the people he's writing to in Rome, they're believers, but they've still got this lingering God is a judge thesis in the back of their minds, and it comes out regularly. And so he just makes it come out by asking this question. Are you still thinking like a legalist? Or have you really embraced this idea that God's grace is a phenomenal offer to you to be a participant in all of the grace things that God can do, rather than being bound up in all the justice things that he might do if he gets sufficiently aggravated by you? Where are you in terms of your theology here? That's basically what he's dealing with. He's wanting his readers in Rome, the believers, to fully embrace God as the God of all grace. So Paul's short answer to the question, did they stumble so as to be completely wiped out in terms of God's future plans? The answer is absolutely not. That's the short answer. But the longer answer is, because God is a gracious God, he is using even this grave wickedness of Israel in crucifying them, their Messiah. He's using that as a foundation for launching the opportunity for salvation into all of the nations by the preaching of the gospel. That's why he told his disciples, go to the uttermost parts of the earth with this. In fact, in the book of the Revelation, Jesus is not even going to come back the second time in his glory until the everlasting gospel has been preached all over the world. So the short answer is no, that's the wrong conclusion to draw. The longer answer is, look what God is doing. He is actually shifting his attention and his message so that he can draw these Gentiles into this blessing that has been formerly basically restricted to Israel. And what does he say? He says in verse 11, by their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make them jealous. Now, why does he want to make them jealous? Well, Paul said that. He said, verse 14, he says in verse 13, I'm speaking to you who are Gentiles, inasmuch as I'm an apostle of Gentiles, I magnify my ministry, if somehow I might move them to jealousy and save some of them. So his whole goal here is to provide a salvation to the Israelites who up to this point have been willful in their resistance and their rebellion. But he says, I've got a plan. I'm going to make them so jealous of the goodness that comes from a God of grace that they're going to want that. So I'm going to go over here and I'm going to do all these things for all these Gentiles, and I'm going to just make them so jealous that they finally say, you know, maybe I ought to quit arguing with God and start getting in on this goodies, on all this good stuff. That's his plan. He's going to use jealousy.